Blog Talk Radio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Hello, and welcome to Provocative Thought, intimately known as TT, striving to awaken those who are asleep, stimulate those who are awakened, feed those who are starving, and nurture those who seek to know. I am your host, Carlton Steed, a self-proclaimed student of life in the search, discovery, and revelation of life on life's terms. First, I'd like to thank WeTalk Productions for allowing me to host this show. I'd also like to thank the creator for allowing me to be. You can contact the show by dialing 909-265-9215. Please press the number 1 to speak. You can reach us on the internet at www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to search and type in WeTalk Productions and listen to the show live. You can also contact us on Facebook at Provocative Thought PT Organization. Next week, we'll be moving to speaker.com. Tonight's topic, the Middle East War. Why and when did the United States decide to interject themselves into the politics of the Middle East. Well, being of little political knowledge, I took time to explore how this fire in the Middle East got started. It seems the Middle East is a part of the spoils of war, World War I and World War II. From encyclopedia.com, British involvement in the region long before World War I, but Britain's movement in the Middle East, as it has been called, the period in which it was the dominant power in much of the area, lasted from 1914 to 1956. The axis of Britain's Middle Eastern Empire stretched from the Suez Canal to the Persian Gulf at its height between the two world wars. That's World War I and World War II. Britain's supremacy was almost unchallenged, either by other powers or by indigenous forces, that the people that lived there in the area that they controlled. Yet after 1945, British dominance quickly crumbled. From the historian, 2017, Wiley Connections. On August 8, 1944, the Anglo-American Petroleum Agreement was signed, dividing Middle Eastern oil between the United States and Britain. Now, agreement was signed twice. Once after World War I, that was the first attempt, and the second attempt occurred at the end of World War II. In 1944, the United States and the United Kingdom, right, England, right, signed an agreement guaranteeing each other equal access to the world's oil reserves. Now, that's deep right there. That's a deep statement to make right there. So, U.S. made a similar proposal after the First World War due to the U.S. and British arguing over the future of Iraq's oil. So if you think that was a new development, this whole thing about Iraq, think again. U.S. economic planning included rebuilding a liberal capitalist world order. U.S. economic planning included rebuilding a liberal capitalist world order based on free exchange of goods and capital to forestall the collapse of global trade, guarantee prosperity, discourage economic nationalism, which U.S. Officials determined to be the rise of fascism and communism and ultimately provoked another war. Now, that's what we call motive. That's the motive for being in the Middle East. It's not validation for being there, but it is confirmation of why they are in the Middle East. The whole communist scare comes into play if the U.S. or U.S. interest groups, corporations become oil dependent on communists for economic or economic nationalists. Communists have been the boogeymen for some time. You know, the communist, that's like a bad word in a capitalist society or a nation and things like that, right? And kind of conflicts with capitalism in some ways. These are the same communists who fought with the U.S. and England in World War I and World War II. Is capitalism a bad word in communist states? It probably doesn't matter who they are as much as what interest groups or corporations are able to do with them. oil may have started this fire, but I think it may have become more complex, more personal. Anyway, we can go to school for a hot second. From dictionary, communism is a political theory derived from Karl Marx, they say, advocating a class war and leading to a society in which all property is publicly owned and each person works and is paid according to their abilities and needs. I kind of like Encyclopedia Britannica's definition. It says communism, a political and economic doctrine that aims to replace private property and the profit-based economy with public ownership and communal control of at least the major means of production, right? That's the mines, the mills, and the factories, everything that you depend on. I mean, Michael Jackson can sing as many songs as he wants, make as much money as he wants in a communist economy. But you guys that control the water, the natural resources, the things that we need, you guys are not, you're not going to be able, well, you shouldn't be able to export the community. Anyway, communism is thus a form of socialism, a higher form, or as they say, a higher or more advanced form of socialism. So exactly how communism differs from socialism has long been a matter of debate, because I always wondered that myself, because they seem very close. Anyway, that will make a capitalist cry. Real estate is one of the biggest scams on the planet. Who did they buy the land from? It sounds like people rule. All people benefit in communism. But do they? From U.S. Legal, economic nationalism, which I never heard of before, refers to an economic policy used by a nation for protecting the domestic market or opening up foreign markets through unilateral or bilateral government actions. Economic nationalism is characterized by extensive government control of trade and the subjection of economic matters to overriding considerations of political and military policy. Okay? So they talked about all this. And some citizens assembly said free trade is good for consumers. It reduces prices by eliminating tariffs and increasing competition. In principle, this will make goods and services cheaper. In contrast, protectionism can result in destructive trade wars that increase costs and uncertainty as each side attempts to protect its own economy. There are several arguments in favor of free trade. So they said it increases productivity, it reduces prices by eliminating tariffs, it reduces the cost of trading by them not having to pay all these different types of tariffs and regulations, respond to these different regulations. It result in destructive. Increases costs and uncertainty. No, it's favoring big businesses. That's what it says it does. They have the resources to lobby. They said protectionist rules can tend to favor big business. So they go on to arguments against protectionism, traditional arguments for protectionism. As countries experience industrial development, traditional domestic industries can decline. Shipbuilding industry has declined in the face of international competition. More people, more nations coming up. Industrial development in different nations. Now you have more people competing for the steel. So they help preserve jobs in this sector, so at least slow the process of change. Protectionism, this is protecting your national economic and resources. Help build up new industries. Safeguard strategic industries such as energy, water, steel, armaments, and food, as we just said. Free trade deals can lead to a lowering of standards. Like, I want to make a cheaper TV, so I make this TV. It looks just like the good one. but it's cheaper. It breaks down, you know. So these guys are, you know, because actually you can make the same product at a cheaper rate and just sell it cheaper. You don't really have to put cheaper parts in there. You just not by not selling it as much, make more money like drug dealers do. He's giving people more better quality of drug at a lesser price, and then you're going to sell a lot of that product. So you can do the same thing with merchandise and things like that. So anyway, if you don't quite understand what's been said up to this point, you can summarize it that it has something to do with money and power. Two things: the average Joe doesn't have a nickel in this social, economical, political quarter. The reason why the U.S. is over in the Middle East? Money, power. Power, money. Right? In this case, the resources, oil. There would have to be someone in the Arab country who agrees to be in political bed with the U.S. and England. That would cause some dissension among the people of that particular nation. U.S. interests or presence there may be viewed as a threat to the Union of Arab Nations or a particular Arab nation or leader. Right? Because that would be like, that's a foreign entity. Just imagine Arab troops on American soil. So remember the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 in Cuba and the Cuban missile incident in 1962. It was viewed as an act of aggression. Somehow it seems that the influence of communism is secondary to what is actually happening in the Middle East. Okay, because anyway, the presence of soldiers is indicative of the presence of opposition in a country. It is indicative of an invasion, at least to those in opposition to their presence. That's what I was just saying, but imagine any Arab nation soldiers being here on U.S. soil. That would make the foreign soldiers and their hosts, the Arab brothers who invited them there, right? Or and if it happened in the United States, the American brothers that invited them on American soil, that would make them enemies to the opposition in that country, right? Seems like not having a nickel in that social, economical, political quarter is not limited to the United States policy. All right? So here we have a situation where some people just, you know, it could be sound like it could just be just as simple as get out of my country, get away from my people. Like, you know, hey, get these guys out of here. You know, well, they're controlling, you know, you guys. You know, leaders, Arab leaders in Arab countries and things like that. So, what part of the word civilized does all this mass destruction relate to? Because it's weird. You know, it's supposed to be a more civilized society, world. I don't know how you want to look at it, you know, but it's. Doesn't seem that way to me. It seems like on a world basis, we had the same thing going on that we have in the hood. You know, we got a lot of people being aggressive toward each other, trying to take over people, manipulate people, post up, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know. It just looks like, you know, the guys on the street jockeying for territory and members of the community, the world community, right, become collateral damage, as you see on the news. You know, all the people who are not, all the civilians that are injured, traumatized as a matter of this war. You know, so the question, you know, if all lives matter, you can't prove it by looking at the world stage. You can't use that to make a statement that all lives matter. I'm beginning to think that you need to defend yourself by any means necessary, because this thing is crazy. Anyway, a U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq with about 177,000 troops in March of 2003. The reason why? The George Bush administration stated Saddam Hussein, right, had weapons of mass destruction and ties to terrorism. Whew. Right, and you know what happened with that situation. You know, they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. Found his brother in a hole somewhere, in a ditch somewhere, trying to hide out. And basically ransacked his country. There was never any weapons of mass destruction. So, anyway. But this thing has gotten bigger than Iraq. Because as I said earlier, these guys made an agreement. Saying like they were talking about the world. They were, you know, so what world were they referring to? Like how far do they want to have control or access to these resources and power? I mean, how do you get to say something like that? From Brookings, 60 years ago this month, the United States first sent combat troops into the Middle East. July 1958, Marine landed in Beirut, Lebanon. Thus began the era of America's now seemingly endless wars in this region. Bruce Rydell says, in reference to United States foreign policy, the Marine Corps battalion in full combat gear stormed a beach near Beirut in July 15, 1958. Right? It was a coordinated Western intervention intended to prop up friendly governments in the region. Now, that's a nice way of saying put puppets in office. Now, depending on which side of the fence you want, that right there is a threat to you, because you don't put people who are going to do what you want them to do in office. Coordinated Western, right, intervention intended to prop up, right? You know how you prop something up? That's something you control, a prop. You control props, right? So government control basically is it looks like it's a government ran by these guys, but really it's ran by the Americans. President Dwight David Eisenhower sent troops to Beirut because of a coup. On July 14th in Baghdad, that's Iraq, in the 1950s, Iraq was the world's strongest ally in the Arab world, right? So President Dwight Eisenhower, right, sent the troops there because it was a coup. Somebody was taking over, trying to take Iraq over. And Iraq was the West, right, strongest ally in the Arab world. How did it get to be the strongest ally in the 50s? And then now you just sending the troops over there to kill Saddam, later on. So that's very interesting. The strongest ally was Iraq. Iraq was the only Arab country to join the so-called Baghdad Pact that Eisenhower envisioned. That's even weirder. He's from the West. How is he envisioning something for the brothers in the so-called Middle East? We're not going to get into the no such thing as the Middle East and all that stuff right there. We all know what we're talking about right here. But here we got a Westerner making plans, again, puppet plans for the people in the so-called Middle East. See, that's kind of a problem right there when you had that type of scenario. Because the people there need to be managing their own business. And, you know, he's viewed as an outsider, certainly. So, trying to look at this thing from both sides. I know that sounds like colonialism. Setting up puppet governments and so forth like that. There's nothing new about that. Anyway, he envisioned as the Middle Eastern version of NATO containing the Soviet Union. America's great opponent in the region was Egypt's charismatic president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, demonized by Israel, France, and England. Some more outsiders. Okay. Nasser was seen by many as a stalking horse for the Soviets early in 1958, Egypt and Syria united to form the United Arab Republic, which Arab nationalists hoped would lead to the unification of the Arabs from the ocean to the Gulf. Nasser would be its ruler. Lebanon's Maronite Christian president, and I probably butchered that word right there. Moronite Christian president Kamil Chum was a fierce enemy of Nasser. He was facing rebellion by the country's Muslim population and many Christians who were sympathetic to Nasser. Chum was trying to get a second term as president, which was unconstitutional and deeply unpopular. He blamed the troubles on Nasser and aligned the United Arab Republic was smuggling and alleged that the Arab Republic was smuggling arms to the rebels in his country. The United Nations inspector did not support Chum's allegations. So he called the big dogs on him and they checked it out and said they ain't doing that. So anyway, the coup in Iraq came as a complete surprise to the American and British intelligence committees. It was also violent. The Iraqi army brutally executed King Faisal and the Crown Prince, as well as the Prime Minister. Baghdad was in turmoil. The coup makers were unknown, but immediately expressed support for Nasser. I just recently read that Baghdad was formed by the British conquerors. Anyway, that's just, you know, Washington panicked. The usually unflappable Eisenhower, I guess he's supposed to be the dude pretty cool, like laid back, didn't get excited about too many things. He convened a National Security Council emergency meeting on July 14th. Director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, estimated that the coup would lead to a wave of pro-Egyptian regime change across the Arab world. Lebanon and Jordan would collapse. Vice President Richard Nixon suggested intervening in Baghdad. Eisenhower later said in his memoirs that we feared the worst, the complete annihilation of Western influence in the Middle East. He ordered the Marines to assault the beach in Beirut the next day to save the Chum government. And the British sent paratroopers to back up King Hussein in Jordan. Ain't that something? So they went over there not to save those people, to salvage Western influence in the Middle East. That's not the same as I'm coming to help you. That's me coming to help myself. All right? The landing was almost comet. They said the Marines expected D-Day. Instead, what happened? They came up on a beach. People was on a beach. You know how what people do on a beach. Bikinis, drinks, that kind of stuff. You know, they were just there. So they wasn't even, you know, war ready, thinking about war. Anyway, within days, it became apparent that the coup in Baghdad was not controlled by Nasser. Instead, the new Iraqi regime became something of a rival to Egypt as the spearhead of Arab nationalism. Eisenhower sent a senior diplomat to Beirut who eased Chum out of office and replaced him with the army commander. This is another Western intervention in the Middle East. So far, it's a lot of Western intervention, and particularly the United States and England in the Middle East. Yeah, England, you know, apparently they were the rulers there at one time, sole rulers. But after World War One, the United States wanted a piece of that pie. What pie? That oil pie. So let me see. So Eisenhower basically sent somebody to get this guy out of office. So he had to be a puppet in order for a Westerner to come and ease him out of political office and replace him with an army commander. He had to be a puppet figure in his country, which means he works for the Westerners. The intervention was strongly criticized in the Congress. Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy said the administration was demonizing Nasser, who was not a Soviet puppet and should work with Arab nationalism. He predicted the remaining monarchies in Arabia would be swept away if they did not reform. His colleague, William Fulbright, was against the intervention in Beirut and argued against it on the 14th in the White House. All right, so we got these, you know, we got the people, the Westerners, not in agreement. Only one Marine died in combat in Beirut. That's an invasion. Only one person died. I'm surprised anybody died coming up on a beach with people with bathing suits and soft drinks. A quarter century later, we're not so lucky when another intervention in Beirut went horribly wrong. Today, Americans are engaged in combat across the Middle East in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and elsewhere. He goes on to say, a familiar pattern has emerged. First comes shock and surprise at an unexpected event like the Baghdad coup, right? Then a rush to judgment that the worst is inevitable. Demonize the enemy. The sky's falling. We must do something. Well, I think that's very interesting what this guy is saying, because number one, you're talking about Western interest in the Middle East and us going to war, U.S. going to war because of that, because these people are making changes in their own, you know, within their own government. Or is it their government? Or are these people a conquered people who are supposed to be of submissive, right, to Western conquerors? Is that the way it's supposed to go? Because that's what it sounds like to me. I could be wrong. But it sounds very much like that. He set up the puppet government and opened up the doors so that you can exploit the natural resources of that country. In this case, oil. But this thing has gotten bigger than Iraq, as I said. It's much bigger than Iraq as far as United States intervention, which would mean troops on the ground, or political behind doors in dark corners or have wherever they make these decisions at with whoever they're making them with, whatever leader they're in bed with, is in bed with them and so forth, whatever puppet they have put in place, whatever person that's working with them. Because not everybody's a puppet. Some people just are in agreement with the program. And I guess that would make them a different type of a puppet, self, you know, motivated individual. So anyway, where U.S. troops and military assets are deployed in the Middle East. And I thought this was very interesting because it goes to speak to, like I'm saying, and with this oil, this in the beginning they made this agreement about how open they would be for these two countries, United States and Britain, would be always be able to get this oil out of the Middle East, right? So it's not a new thing. And this guy says, from, I think this is Axios. Anyway. The killing of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi military commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike has put the world on edge, with Iran promising revenge. Right? The U.S. is preparing to deploy about 3,000 additional troops to the region and has already sent 750 troops as protesters attacked the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. That's a hot mess over there. By the numbers, the U.S. has nearly 800 military bases around the world. 800. Now, somebody help me out with that. Because I would have never imagined that the United States had 800 military bases around the world. Now, that's not this, you know. So what are they controlling? And what's going on? Are they like hired guns for people, or are they oppressors? What are they in these countries? Because that is weird. How many of you guys knew that they are nearly 800 military bases around the world. 800. I know we all heard about Japan, Germany, you know, things like that, and over in the Middle East where not too happy to be find yourself. Anyway, by the numbers, the U.S. has nearly 800 military bases around the world. U.S. and U.S. Central Command has said between 60,000 and 70,000 U.S. troops are in the Middle East. 60,000 and 70,000 U.S. troops are in the Middle East. So y'all know, here's where they are. And we're going to look for the common denominator for where these troops are. We're just going to look, see if we can find. So where are they? Well, they're in Afghanistan. 14,000 U.S. troops, plus 8,000 NATO soldiers. Afghanistan is an oil dry country. Now, I thought that was weird. I said, oh, well, okay. All right. Iran, more than 7,000 American troops, mostly Navy. Iraq, 5,200 U.S. troops. Jordan, about 2,795 U.S. troops. Kuwait, over 13,000 American troops. That was the country that Saddam invaded in the first war over there, the first Gulf War, I guess you could say, you know, Gulf War 1. So so it's not funny, but, you know. Oman, a few hundred U.S. soldiers are in Oman. Just a few hundred. Those guys are vulnerable. Qatar, as many as 13,000 American troops. 13, that's a lot. That's a lot. That's a lot. Saudi Arabia, which you probably already know. And I think people know Saudi Arabia, but they have 3,000 U.S. troops will be deployed to Saudi Arabia. But I heard they already have troops guarding the oil refinery fields, whatever, the air base in Saudi Arabia or something like that. That's what I heard. I don't know, but this thing didn't cover any of that. Syria. U.S. Central Command is unable to disclose how many troops are in Syria. So maybe they're having an all-out war in Syria. I don't know. Turkey. It's unclear, but the country's strategic location makes it valuable for transporting arms and people. Okay. United Arab Emirates, 5,000 U.S. troops are stationed there. They said yes. There are other U.S. bases in the region, but the locations aren't disclosed for security purpose. So, sounds like there's a war, an all-out war going on. It has been going on for some time. It's never stopped. World War I and World War II, the war between the European nations stopped, but this war never stopped. So, since the Gulf War, which is, that occurred, August 1990, to February 1991, Operation Desert Storm is another name for it. Even prior to the Gulf War, the United States had thrown its immense military, diplomatic, and economic weight behind the monarchs of the Persian Gulf. This is from the Institute for Policy Studies. They said that they all... Though these people rule less than 10% of the Arab world, the total population, the regimes control most of the wealth there. So, prior to the war, it was difficult for the United States to engage in military exercises or even arrange a port without asking for permission months in advance. Not anymore. Basically, they have influence with the people who have power in the Middle East. And that's the way you do it. I mean, that's the way you get into somebody's turf. You start at the top. Anyway, from history, Iraq leader Saddam Hussein ordered the invasion and occupation of neighboring Kuwait in early August 1990. Alarmed by his actions, fellow Arab powers such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt called on the United States and other Western nations to intervene, right? Hussein defied United Nations Security Council demands to withdraw from Kuwait. The Persian Gulf War began with massive U.S.-led Air Force offensive known as Operation Desert Storm. You know what happened over there, right? That wasn't a long time ago. They basically almost bombed Saddam out of business. So, there you have the relationship. Individuals who have relationship with Westerners, and Maybe I guess this thing works for them also, you know, the people in power, because nobody's taking their power away from them. They remain in power, and the U.S. gets what they want, and they get what they want, power and wealth. So, who are these people that they're fighting over there? Because it can't be the people that, I mean, it could be the wealthy people doing, the double cross. Could be. It could be supported by some of the wealthy people. Anyway, but makes you think, what's going on over there? We have outsiders, Westerners, intervention. We have indigenous people, we'll call them that. And they are some working with the Westerners, and we have others who are not submissive to Western rule. The New World Order, it's not, when you go against them, you get what Saddam got. Blasted. He wasn't prepared for that. From Foreign Affairs, United States military footprint has hardly changed under Trump. Oh, I forgot to mention. Are those all those countries that I mentioned where United States troops are, they have one thing in common. Oil. 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 That's the common denominator. They say under Trump, the U.S. military presence in the Middle East has not changed much at all. They said hundreds of U.S. Forces remain in Syria with an open-ended mandate, one that goes beyond the initial rationale for development, which was focused squarely on fighting the Islamic State, also known as ISIS. Concern about their threat from Iran has brought about some change in military presence, but so far they add up to a far smaller uptick than has been hyped. Even the most noteworthy among them, the return of several hundreds of U.S. troops to Prince Sultan's air base in Saudi Arabia demonstrates that recent alterations to force posture in the region have been smaller and more incremental than the public debate around them might suggest. Okay, so the only consistent thing I see is oil. Afghanistan. What is that 18-year-old war all about? All they have is poppy seed plants and the Taliban. From the Washington Post. Afghanistan demonstrates the global opium market last year. Afghanistan dominates the global opium market. Last year, it produced 82% of the world's supply, according to the estimates by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, defying U.S. efforts to curtail it. Afghan opium production has skyrocketed over the course of the 18-year war. Ever since the United States have been in Afghanistan, the production of opium, which is used to make heroin, right, has skyrocketed, not increased. Skyrocketed from global resources. It said the drug war, American troops are protecting Afghan opium. U.S. occupation leads to an all-time high heroin production. That's right. They said the opium production in Afghanistan has been on the rise since U.S. occupation started in 2001. Indeed. A brand new report from the United Nations finds that opium production is at an all-time high. Get it? So why are they there? Makes one of those things that makes you go, hmm. According to a report, cultivation of poppies across the war-torn nation rose 33% in 2013, and total opium production amounted to 5,500 tons, up by almost half since 2012. This has never been witnessed before in the history of Afghanistan, said Jean-Luc Lamieux, I think that's how you say that, and the outgoing leader of the Afghanistan Office of the United Nations Office on Drug and Crime, which produced a report. The U.S. military has allowed poppy cultivation to continue in order to appease farmers and government officials involved with the drug trade who might otherwise turn against the Afghan Karzai government in Kabul, fueling both sides. In fact, the opium and heroin industry is both a product of the war and an essential source for continued conflict. Public intelligence has published a series of photographs showing American U.S. trained Afghan troops patrolling poppy fields in Afghanistan. From Wikipedia. The United States invasion of Afghanistan started on October 7, 2001. The United States sought to remove the Taliban from power as they were hosting al-Qaeda terrorists and camps who were the main suspects in the September 11 attacks. You know, that was when they blew up the trade centers. 9/11, right? 2,300 troops have died. 20,589 were wounded in this Afghani war. So the question becomes, and you know, this is tip of the iceberg. I just did this just to ask myself a question, like, what is the big deal about being in the Middle East? What's going on over there? Because they say we don't get most of our oil from there. But you have to think out of the box. You have to think like a person who's trying to control things. If you're trying to control things, it's not about if I'm getting most of my oil from of a place or not. It's if you have something that I want to control it. So there's a reserve. So you want to have control or access, as they said in that treaty. This is the motivation for being there, oil. Right? Oil was the motivation. And as you can see, there was a treaty made between the United States, right? The Anglo-American Petroleum Agreement was signed, dividing Middle Eastern oil between the United States and Britain. How can you do that? Like, without the people's permission. That's the mentality that we have here going on. Our dependency on oil, I think, inflames this whole Middle East issue. You know, we can get off of it. Oil is like our heroin, apparently. And I guess we got a heroin issue going on, too, because Afghanistan producing over 80% of the world's heroin. So we have a double whammy because we have a heroin problem here in this country also. So I don't know. Call me stupid or whatever it is, you know, but damn, this thing seems like it stinks from here to, you know, I just smell a rat, maybe a bunch of rats. Yeah, this doesn't look good to me. And you got these guys going over here. Basically fighting some people who are fighting them because they're there. They don't want to be submissive to Western rule. So it makes me wonder who's the real enemy over there. And I guess when you're at war, the other side is the enemy. It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. That doesn't matter. What matters is that you know when you're in a war situation, you're the enemy of the other person, and the other person is your enemy. But it's a shame we have to end up that way. It's a shame that this whole thing is going down, and through a whole web of war, manipulation, you know. And we're all being manipulated, you know. This whole thing, our dependency on oil, we should be moving away from that. If we got to control other people, natural resources, go on and put soldiers on the ground so that we can work with our puppet governments, and we don't need that. You know, go to something else. Are we an advanced civilization or not? I mean, why are we still, maintaining this dependency on oil like that, you know? Anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And I got all this, it's not my story. That was from different sources, U.S. Legal, and different places, you know. But really, we really need to, the sad part is that now if you leave, like I think Trump pulled some soldiers out of, what did he pull the soldiers out of? He pulled them out in Afghanistan somewhere. And the minute that them guys left, they came in and started killing those people. That's the downside of it. That the people who are allies, who are supposed to be allies, because you're not supposed to really run out on people like that. If you know they're going to be harmed, you're not supposed to run out on them. But Trump pulled some soldiers out of there, and I'm not saying it's good for them to be there or bad for them to be there, but I'm saying the situation always exists. You got people that's down with you in the Middle East, and you just abandon them. That's wrong. Because they put their lives in jeopardy to assist you in your objective, and in response, you say, you on your own, bud. That's not a good look. Anyway, back to the original question. Why? Because we know when. About when. And it probably been there before that. But we know why. The one consistent thing that I see is these countries are all oil-producing countries. So I hope this thing doesn't, turn into an all-out war. But it already appears to be an all-out war. If you have soldiers in about, 8 Middle Eastern countries, soldiers, not advisors, not, that's a problem. Until next week. And as I said, next week we'll be coming from, we're moving from Blog Talk to Speaker.com. Until next week, each one reach one, each one teach one. Peace, y'all.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in 4 parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Shape of a War Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news, and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.